This morning's scripture reading is from Job chapter 31, verses 13 through 28. If I have denied justice to my men servants and maid servants when they had a grievance against me, what will I do when God confronts me? What will I answer when I'm called to account? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both within our mothers? If I have denied the desires of the poor or let the eyes of the widow grow weary, if I have kept my bread to myself, not sharing it with the fatherless, but from my youth I reared him as would a father, and from my birth I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perishing for lack of clothing, or a needy man without a garment, and his heart did not bless me for warming him with the fleece from my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless, knowing that I had influence in court, then let my arm fall from the shoulder, let it be broken off at the joint, for I dreaded destruction from God, and for fear of his splendor, I could not do such things. If I have put my trust in gold or said to pure gold, you are my security, if I have rejoiced over my great wealth, the fortune my hands had gained, if I have regarded the sun in its radiance or the moon moving in splendor so that my heart was secretly enticed and my hand offered them a kiss of homage, then these also would be sins to be judged, for I would have been unfaithful to God on high. This is the word of the Lord.
This fall, we're in a series of sermons on the theme of gospel in the world. We're looking at some of the ideas and the concepts and the theological themes that have formed Redeemer as a church that have made us who we are. And in particular, as Redeemer thinks about the years to come, how these concepts and how these themes and how these ideas will continue to shape us. In particular, we're looking at the ways in which the gospel causes us to be a healing and a restoring influence on the world around us, gospel in the world. And hopefully this will help us to think about the ways in which the city around us could be a more civil place, a more equitable and a more peace-filled place, a less hostile and a less impoverished place, more humane and more human because of our presence here. Today we're going to talk about the topic of justice. Now, immediately, when you hear that there will be a sermon on justice, many of us bristle, and we have hairs that stand on end. I know this. I can see all of you from here, and I know that you're squirming already. And in fact, if you're not already squirming, I'm a minister. I can see into your hearts, and I know that you're squirming in your hearts. Why? In much of American discourse, our society is deeply, deeply divided on the mere definition of justice. What constitutes justice? Here's an example. Most people you talk with will agree that global poverty is a problem, that there is something that is fundamentally broken and there's something that's fundamentally flawed in the world, that there are resources available to alleviate poverty, and yet there are resources in part of the world where the need is not great, and they're lacking in parts of the world where the need is great. Most people will agree that that is a problem. Yet when it comes to suggesting a solution, people are deeply, deeply divided. Those on the political left will say something like, the just thing to do is this. Those on the political right will say, the just thing to do is this. And in fact, those on the left will say the unjust thing to do is what the right is suggesting. And those on the right will say that the unjust thing to do is what the left is suggesting. Never the twain shall meet. And yet, even with these differences, what everyone is pretty much agreed upon universally is that no one ever believes that they are on the side of injustice. This morning, we're going to look at the biblical idea of justice. Job chapter 29 and Job 31 are two of the most important specific texts on what the righteous and the just life looks like. And so we'll consider three things this morning related to the topic of justice. We'll consider first the lifestyle of justice, then the heart of justice, and then the beauty of justice. It's lifestyle, it's heart, and it's beauty. First, the lifestyle. What you see in the Bible is a view of human dignity, and therefore a view of social justice is absolutely distinct in all ancient world religions or worldviews. Verse 13, it says, "If I have denied justice to my men servants and maid servants when they had a grievance against me, what will I do when God confronts me?" This particular word, grievance, is the Hebrew word pronounced reeve. Broadly speaking, it means a dispute, some kind of gripe or a complaint. But in the Bible, it's used very, very specifically as a legal term. It's always used in a court of law. In other words, it's not just a complaint. It's a charge. And it's a case that you might bring against someone else. It's a lawsuit. So, for instance, in the book of Exodus, there's a story about the people of Israel and how they quarrel with Moses about the fact that he had led them into the desert where they were thirsty. And they use in that passage the word reeve. So they quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." Moses replied, "Why do you quarrel with me, reeve? Why do you put the Lord to the test?" Literally, they are bringing Moses up on charges. They're putting him on trial and they're suing him in a court of law. What's fascinating is that throughout the Old Testament, this word reeve is not just used of one business party suing or bringing a charge against another business party. It's often used of the disadvantaged when they sue those who are advantaged. Or it's used of the powerless when they bring a case against the powerful. Exodus chapter 23, we read this. It says, "Do not show favoritism to a poor man in his lawsuit," reeve. Later on, it says, "Do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuits." As tempting as it might be to take advantage of the disadvantaged, do not show favoritism and do not deny justice to the disadvantaged. Verse 13 describes servants, not just men servants, but maid servants too. "If I've denied justice to my med servants and maid servants," and what it means to protect them and not to show favoritism or to deny justice is that there is, according to the Bible, some inalienable, inviolable dignity to the human person that cuts across gender, men servants and maid servants. It cuts across economic and hierarchical lines, servants suing masters. And because servants were often foreigners, it cuts across ethnic lines as well, which is why Job says, "Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both within our mothers?" Whether you are a man or a woman, servant or a master, a Jew or an alien, there's the same dignity. And this is utterly distinct amongst all ancient worldviews. So, for instance, by comparison, Aristotle. Aristotle was a smart man. He, along with Greek philosophers, believed that human dignity was a function of rational capacity, that it was not equal among people. It was dependent upon your cognitive ability. And he said that some people were born to rule, others were born to be ruled, in other words, to be slaves. So Aristotle once wrote this, "Nature would like to distinguish between the bodies of free men and slaves, making the one strong for servile labor, the other upright, and although useless for such services, useful for political life. It is clear, then, that some men are by nature free and others slaves, and that for these latter, slavery is both expedient and right." It's Aristotle. Vinod Ramachandra is a Christian Sri Lankan scholar, and he says that in virtually all ancient cultures of the world, the power of the gods was always channeled through the elites of society, that the gods always favored those who were in positions of advantage and privilege. They always identified with kings, with emperors, with priests, with pharaohs, and so on. Societal elites were proxies for the god, and therefore for the gods, and therefore elites were always given preferential treatment. They were not to be offended, because in offending social elites, you would offend the gods. And that's the reason why many ancient law codes suggest a different degree of punishment depending on the social class of the people that you offended. You know, what you see in the Bible is that even if you are a foreign female maidservant, you have the same dignity and you have the same standing as high-ranking male elites. And this is what Ramachandra writes. He writes, "But here in Israel's rival vision, it is not high-ranking males, but the orphan, the widow, and the stranger with whom Yahweh takes his stand. His power is exercised in history for their empowerment." And in these verses, verses 16 through 23, we see three categories of dispossessed people. And then in verse 32, which is not in your program, there is a fourth category. The first one is the widow. Read, "If I have denied the desires of the poor, or let the eyes of the widow grow weary." Now, in Israel, inheritance always came in the form of land. Because Israel was an agrarian economy, your entire livelihood depended upon your possession of land, food, clothing, home, income. But on top of all the material resources, food, clothing, income, there was this deep, inextricable spiritual significance to the land. It was something that God had given. It was the inheritance and the birthright for the people of Israel. So for years, Israel had been wanderers. They had been nomads. The land was a reminder that God provided a home. And so it was a symbol of God's generosity, of his kindness. It was a reminder that there was place and community and security, and that there was a home. And in fact, anyone who was ever disadvantaged in Israel, they always shared in common the fact that they had somehow been extracted or dislocated from the land. In Israel, inheritance always passed through male descendants. It was always patrilineal. So if you're a widow, and if you had no male spouse, not only did you have no material resources, no food, no clothing, and so on, you had also lost anything that could connect you to your spiritual inheritance. There's nothing to sustain you. There's nothing to hold you up, both physically or spiritually. It's not just that you had no house, but that you had no place to call your home. Put it this way, to be a widow in Israel was not just a marital status, it was a social status, and it was a spiritual status. But second, there's the orphan, the fatherless. It says, "If I have kept my bread to myself, not sharing it with the fatherless." Just like for the widow, what was critical was that you were, in Israel, connected to a person who had land and had inherited, namely a male, either a husband or a father. And that's why Old Testament passages always talk about the fatherless, the plight of the fatherless, and not just the parentless. What it meant to be without a father is not just that you had lost a parent, but that you had lost family. And you had lost a sense of home. You were totally disinherited. Third, there is the naked man, the one who is destitute. It says here, "If I've seen anyone perishing for lack of clothing, or a needy man without a garment." Everywhere you see clothing in the Bible, it always means inheritance, standing, some kind of birthright. It meant that you had claim to an inheritance. So this is why, for instance, Jonathan gives his tunic to David. It's not because David was cold. It's because David would one day be king. And so he gives to David the rightful kingly inheritance symbolized by his garment. This is also why Joseph's brothers envied Joseph for his coat. It's not because he looked good. It's not because it was sort of hot off the runway, you know, freshest looks of the season. It's because it signaled the fact that he had a special inheritance, a unique standing in the family. And of course, there's the obvious problem with the lack of clothing. There's nothing to protect you from cold desert nights. There's nothing to protect you from hot desert days. There is a problem of physical exposure. But the deeper problem meant that you had no inheritance. There's no claim on the land. You're utterly dispossessed. And fourth, verse 32 describes the wanderer, the person who is the alien in the land. Verse 32 says, "But no stranger had to spend the night in the street, for my door was always open to the traveler." Because inheritance always passed through Israelite men, if you were an alien, or if you were a foreigner, a wanderer on the land, it could be generations, and maybe never, that you would be connected to the land. You had no claim on the land, and therefore you are forever wandering, no place to call home. So what you see in each one of these is not just that they were materially deprived, but they were disenfranchised and dispossessed. There's no connection to any inheritance. And so to be poor in the Bible is not just economically, didn't mean just being economically impoverished. It meant being spiritually, socially, communally, emotionally impoverished and cut off as well. It's not just the lack of money, it's the lack of humanity. And what you see about biblical justice, about the lifestyle of justice, is that it doesn't just relieve specific needs or the material plight of the needy. It rehumanizes the needy. It defends, and it protects, and it reinstates the disinherited and restores a sense of humanity and wholeness. I'll put it this way. Biblical justice means to return people to the land and to protect people in the land, which is why Job says, "If I have denied the desires of the poor or let the eyes of the widow grow weary." True justice means turning the poor man's life into a delight. And it means restoring and protecting the widow and the orphan and the destitute and the wanderer, giving back humanity and dignity. That's the lifestyle of justice. But second, there's a heart of justice. What's important to understand in these verses is that verses 24 to 28 follow verses 16 through 23. And yes, I did go to seminary, so I could tell you that. Verses 24 to 28 don't explicitly talk about justice. They don't explicitly talk about a just society. What's fascinating is that verses 24 to 28 speak about our hearts. We read here, "If I have put my trust in gold or said to pure gold, you are my security. If I have rejoiced over my great wealth, the fortune my hands had gained, my heart secretly enticed, my hand offered them a kiss of homage, then these also would be sins to be judged, for I would have been unfaithful to God on high." Thomas Chalmers was a Scottish Presbyterian minister in the early 19th century, once wrote a treatise called On the Love of Money on these particular verses. And in that treatise, he basically said that there is a difference, a fundamental difference between the love of what money can buy and the love of money itself. Job, it says, "I have rejoiced over my great wealth, the fortune my hands had gained." And he said that while as problematic and as life-altering and destructive as it is to love what money can buy, the love of money is somehow far, far worse. And there are two reasons that he gives. One is that it is irrational, and the other is that it is offensive. It's irrational. When you love what money can buy, concert tickets, clothing, a meal, or a home, there are certain inherent values to those things. So, for instance, a home can be a place of warmth and hospitality and shelter. A nice meal can be a place for a communal experience. A library of books is a way to learn and to grow in your knowledge. And even though more things, home, library, clothing, don't necessarily mean greater happiness, they could enhance life and they could make you hospitable and learned and aesthetically attuned and so on. They can be gifts that God has given to you to enjoy. This is what Chalmers writes. He says, "When we indulge the love of that which is purchased by money, the materials of gratification and the organs of gratification are present with each other, such as the tasting of food, the smelling of a flower. It is a pleasure which may be felt by man." The love of money, on the other hand, according to Chalmers, is much less rational. It's the difference between wealth in use and wealth merely in possession. And at the end of the day, money is currency to make something else happen. And so according to Chalmers, there is something irrational about loving the currency itself and not what it can be used for. It's like loving electricity without loving the light from the lamp. Or it's like loving a television without ever watching it. Or it's like loving a reservoir but never drinking from it. It's irrational. But second, it's offensive, according to Chalmers. If I have put my trust in gold or said to pure gold, you are my security. If I have rejoiced over my great wealth, the fortune my hands had gained. If you were to love something that money can buy more than God, my career more than God, my possessions more than God, my spouse more than God, my reputation more than God, that's still bad. But you're still saying that God gave this to me. Even though you're saying I love gifts more than the giver, you still are acknowledging that God is the giver. You may have forgotten. You may have selectively chosen not to remember he gave it to you. But either way, you still know that he gave it to you. But if you love money more than God himself, if you say that money gave me these things instead of God gave me these things, you see what you've done? You haven't just failed to remember God. You've replaced him. And you didn't forget to thank him. You substituted him, and you forgot him altogether. And according to Chalmers, this is the difference between loving things that money can buy, problematic as it is, versus loving the money itself. It's the difference between forgetting God, that God gave you something, versus forgetting God altogether. And so he writes this. It covers a more daring and positive aggression on the right and territory of God than even infidelity. The latter would only desolate the sanctuary of heaven. The former would set up an abomination in the midst of it. It not only strips God of love, but it transfers them to another. Now, some of you are saying, fine, you made your case. Love of money is bad, it's irrational, it's offensive. But what does this have to do with justice or injustice or protecting the disadvantaged? My personal sins, my behavior, my consumption, it should have nothing to do with the world around me. They're disconnected. What I do in private doesn't harm anyone. But don't be naive. Here's an example. If you were to consume or to purchase counterfeit or pirated goods, or if you were to eat at a restaurant, or if you were to buy products that were produced by underpaid or mistreated laborers, because of an economic interest on your part, you get more for less. Then you can't say that what you do in private and the disposition of your heart has no implication on the world around. You see what happens? First, it shapes you as a person. You begin to say that your commercial interests are more important than the rightful and the just gain or the equitable treatment of a worker. And you begin to treat the entire world and people in commercial terms and not in relational terms. And the other thing that it does is it creates a market for these goods. And it silently endorses the violation of certain labor laws. It perpetuates certain economic disparities in the world, underage or underpaid workers, and so on. The way that we conduct our lives in private, the love of money, and the way that we consume, it has everything to do with how the world becomes a more just or a less just place. Here's another example. It's not exactly related to the love of money and justice, but you'll get the point. A couple of years ago, I was on a subway coming home from a meeting, and I was mugged. And in the end, it turned out fine. My face was sore for a couple of days where I was punched. Healed fine. I had my BlackBerry stolen, but that turned out okay because I went out and bought an iPhone. That was fine. My assailant got some free calls. You know, I lost a phone and had a bruised jaw. Not so bad. But the worst thing about this specific individual act of violence towards me, his sin against me and his coveting of my phone, is it made me believe that people could not be trusted and that the world is unsafe. And it made me slightly less likely to interact with or to help people because I now believe that the world is dangerous. His assault had much vaster implications than free calls at my expense or at the expense of my face. If I had had the presence of mind, I would have said to him, your act of personal covetous of my phone, your act of personal violence towards me, don't you see what it's doing? It's destroying the social fabric of trust in the universe. It makes me and it makes others that I recount the story to believe that the world is fundamentally unsafe, and that's not good for society. Your private sin against me has vast public implications. Though had I said that, I probably really would have gotten beaten up. Whether you think justice has a collective or an individual solution, whether you are liberal-leaning or conservative-leaning politically and economically and socially, either way, what we see in this passage is that our sin and the heart or the lack of it, of justice, whether it's because of the love of money or anything else in our lives other than God, has vast implications and it impacts and it forms the injustices in the world. So, how do we get a heart of true justice? And for this, we have to look at the beauty. Verse 23, we read, for I dreaded destruction from God, and for fear of his splendor, I could not do such things. In other places, this is translated as his majesty. There is a kind of beauty, and there is a kind of majesty and splendor that we can behold that will make us just people. 1999, there was a book written by Harvard professor Elaine Scarry called On Beauty and Being Just. What she suggested in the book was that contrary to people who were saying that there's no such thing as true beauty, it is possible that there is a true beauty that can lead us to be just people. So she puts it this way. First of all, the simple fact that we share the experience of beauty with other people, that you tell people about beautiful things, it means that there are things that are truly beautiful. When you say, listen to this music, read this poem, eat this food, see this painting, and so on. In other words, you only invite someone to see something beautiful if you believe that they might share in that sense of real beauty. And that real beauty, true shared communal beauty, is a reminder that there is something that is good and there is something that is right and order in the world. We want others to praise and enjoy the same beauty with us. Second, she said that true beauty always decenters us. It always focuses our attention away from us as individuals towards something that is more grand, something that's transcendent, something that's outside of ourselves and more beautiful than ourselves. In her book, she quotes a philosopher who tells a story about a time in her life when she was overcome by anxiety, totally overcome by self-pity. But then she sees something beautiful, and it's beautiful enough to change it. And this is what the writer, the philosopher, writes. She writes, we are anxiety-ridden animals. Our minds are continually active, fabricating an anxious, self-preoccupied, falsifying veil which partially conceals the world. I am looking out of my window in an anxious and resentful state of mind, brooding on some damage done to my prestige. Then suddenly, I observe a hovering kestrel. In a moment, everything is altered. The brooding self with its hurt vanity has disappeared. And when I return to thinking of the other matter, it seems less important. J.R.R. Tolkien once wrote that in any good story, there is a deeper story. And there is a more profound narrative that breaks through and that brings an otherworldly beauty and light into any good story, beyond the prose and beyond the characters. There is a beauty that breaks in and shows you a beauty that could change your life. And this is the characteristic of any good story. So Tolkien writes this, he says, "But the consolation of fairy tales has another aspect than the imaginative satisfaction of ancient desires. Far more important is the consolation of the happy ending, the sudden joyous turn. It is a sudden and miraculous grace, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief. It can give to child or man that hears it a catch of the breath, a beat and lifting of the heart near to tears." There is a kind of beauty that can cause us to believe in something good and just and redemptive and hopeful, and it can make us just people. The gospel writers write about the fact that when Jesus died on the cross, God had given him over to the hands of sinful men. And then on the cross, he experiences their injustices against him, the death of an innocent man. You know, what we also read is that when Jesus dies, he experiences the perfect justice of God. Everything about being disenfranchised in the Old Testament, widow without a spouse, a child without a father, destitute without clothing, of inheritance, an alien without a country. All of these were primarily because you had no connection to the land, that you were not only materially disadvantaged because there's no food, no income, no shelter, you're also spiritually dispossessed because you would always be hungry. You would always be wandering. You had no place to call your home. And don't you see, this is precisely why Jesus said, "Foxes have holes, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." And it's also why Isaiah said, "He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people, he was stricken." Jesus Christ on the cross is utterly dispossessed, and he is disinherited. He's a child without a father to give him an inheritance. He's destitute with no coat to show his inheritance. He's utterly stripped. This is why he's naked on the cross. The soldiers cast lots for his garments. And just like a wanderer or an alien without a country, he is crucified outside the city gates with no place to lay his head, totally dislocated from the land. He experiences material impoverishment, no food, no clothing, no shelter. But even more, he experiences total spiritual impoverishment. He's hungry. He is naked, and he is without a home. But see what happens. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. For the transgression of my people, he was stricken. On the cross, Jesus is treated as despised to make us his beauty. And he is treated as if he were without beauty so that he could become our beauty. When the cross becomes a beautiful reality to you, and when it becomes aesthetically charged, a joy beyond the walls of the world, it brings a joy into the walls of your world. And to the extent that that happens, it breaks through your self-centeredness. It breaks through your love of money, your need to fill yourself with other things to be satisfied. Instead of making you self-centered, it makes you radically other-centered. How? Everything we've seen in the passage has been about how our own sin, self-service, the love of money, and so on. That's why there is injustice in the world. And yet when you see Jesus Christ, the one without sin, who experienced the justice of God on your behalf that should have come on you, to the extent that that becomes a beauty to you, you become a person of justice. So put it this way. What's justice? At the end of the day, justice is not merely doing what is right for the world. It's rehumanizing it. It's mending everything in the world that was broken by sin. Now, on the cross, Jesus Christ is abandoned to give you the dignity of being a spouse. He is disinherited as a child to give you the dignity of having a father. And he's stripped of his inheritance, naked, to give you the dignity of a life without shame and to give you a robe of inheritance. And when that becomes a beauty to you, your life becomes one where you're willing to do the same for others. And you're willing to dignify and to protect those who are in need, who have been subject to the experience of injustice. You'll work to alleviate both economic and emotional impoverishment, material and spiritual impoverishment. You're willing to do this for the sake of those around you. And to the extent that you see the beauty of Jesus on the cross, experiencing justice that should have come upon you, you'll become a person of justice, and you'll live justly towards those around you. A friend of mine is a Christian artist and thinker. And every time I say anything, every time I come across a passage to preach that has anything to do with beauty or aesthetics, I always ask him ahead of time, dude, what do you think of this passage? And if you ask him, he'll tell you that the importance of beauty in our lives is that it makes us human. It rehumanizes us. And it reminds us that the most human we will ever be is not when our lives are lived exclusively within the confines of the walls of this world, but when there is a true otherworldly beauty that breaks in so that we can live with otherworldly joy within the confines of this world. It reminds us that when we look to ourselves for true beauty, we'll be impoverished in every possible way. But when we look outside of ourselves for true beauty, that's when we experience true humanity. We remember that we were created for a world more beautiful than the one that we currently experience, and that we were created for a world that is more just than the one that we currently experience. That's when we are rehumanized, and that's when we can work to rehumanize the world around us through lives of justice. He tells me that there is a reason why in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus Christ says, consider the lilies, before he says, seek his kingdom and righteousness. It's because when you see real beauty, the beauty of Jesus Christ and what he has done, you'll have a joy beyond the walls of the world. And it will cause you to work to bring that joy and that rehumanizing justice into the walls of this world. Please pray with me. Our Father, we pray that you would help us. Help us to see the beauty of who you are. Help us to see the beauty of what Jesus Christ has done, the one who bore your justice on our behalf, so that we might become just people. We thank you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.